a button-down shirt, and dress pants, I pulled open the courtroom door. As I neared the front of the room, I saw a lady in a blue dress, Odin Lloyd's mom. My heart broke for her and the entire Lloyd family.
I sat in the first wooden bench on the left side of the courtroom, 6 feet behind where Aaron and his defense team would be stationed.
For several minutes, I rocked back and forth, my nerves on edge. I looked at the empty seats that would be filled by the jury and watched the prosecution organize their notes. Aaron entered the room. The first thing I noticed were the tattoos on his hands, tattoos he had dating back to college that, from a distance, looked like different shades of black ink. I wondered what the jurors' first impression of my brother would be when they saw him. Aaron was big with broad shoulders and still looked like he could play in the NFL. He had kept in shape during his 19 months of incarceration. Before Aaron took his seat next to one of his defense attorneys, Charles Rankin, he looked back at our family section. I was there with our mom, Jeff, Cheyenne, our Uncle David, and our Aunt Lisa. Aaron mouthed the words, "I love you," and "thank you." He sat down. Judge E. Susan Garsh appeared, and the jurors filed in. It was now time for the prosecution to give opening statements. The Bristol County prosecutor, Patrick Bomberg, said that Aaron orchestrated Lloyd's murder and was the trigger man. The state laid out what it believed happened in the early morning hours of June 17, 2013, presenting a timeline. On June 16th, after having dinner and drinks with a few friends, Aaron returned home. He texted two other friends, Ernest Beau Wallace and Carlos Charlie Boy Ortiz, and they drove from Bristol to Aaron's house. Aaron had met Beau through Tanya years earlier, and had only recently started spending time with Carlos. Both Beau and Carlos had criminal records. The three of them then picked up Lloyd just after 2:30 a.m., and drove to a secluded industrial park less than a mile from Aaron's home. The prosecution claimed that Lloyd had recently said something to Aaron that had angered him, and caused Aaron to lose trust in Lloyd. Because of this, the prosecution said, Aaron fatally shot Lloyd 6 times. Video surveillance showed a Nissan Altima, which was rented in Aaron's name, outside of Lloyd's house at 2:33 a.m. About an hour later, more video surveillance revealed Aaron, Beau, and Carlos returning to Aaron's house without Lloyd in the car. A text message that Lloyd sent to his sister indicated he was with someone he referred to as NFL before he was killed. The prosecutor also presented an image from Aaron's personal home surveillance system that revealed Aaron carrying a dark-shaped object in his hands as he stood in his front foyer. The prosecution alleged that it was the Glock used in the killing of Lloyd. They went on to allege that the gun was disposed of by Shy the next day. Shy was charged with perjury, but the charge was eventually dropped. Aaron's lawyers went next. "Aaron Hernandez is an innocent man," said Michael Fee, one of Aaron's lawyers. "The evidence will show that Aaron Hernandez did not murder his friend Odin Lloyd, nor did he ask or orchestrate anyone else to murder him. Aaron Hernandez is not guilty. We are here because the police and prosecutor targeted Aaron from the very beginning. As soon as they found out that Aaron Hernandez, the celebrity football player, the New England Patriot, was a friend of Odin Lloyd's, it was over. Aaron never had a chance." After the opening statements, Judge Garsh gave the jury instructions. "The Commonwealth is not required to prove that the defendant himself performed the act that caused Odin Lloyd's death," she said. "However, to establish the defendant is guilty of murder, the Commonwealth must prove 2 things beyond a reasonable doubt. First, the Commonwealth must prove that the defendant knowingly participated in the commission of that crime, and second, the Commonwealth must prove that he did so with the intent required to commit that crime." Walking out of the courtroom after the first day, I was torn. The timeline and information the prosecutors presented raised questions about what happened on that early morning. And when they showed Aaron with what looked like a gun in his front foyer, I felt a punch to the gut. I knew that any picture of my brother holding a gun was not going to help his case. It looked bad, but I needed more information. For the first few days of the trial, I sat in the courtroom and hoped the jurors were not like my mother, who believed Aaron was probably guilty before the trial even started because of all the negative articles she had read about him. All I wanted was for the jurors to have open minds and determine the case based on the facts presented, not what had been previously reported in the media. But I understood that was going to be difficult to do, because of the extensive coverage Aaron's case had received from the moment his name was first tied to Odin's death. After several days of sitting behind Aaron, I had to return to work in Iowa. But my heart never left Aaron's side, and my mind never left the courtroom. A few nights later, in my Iowa City apartment, I dropped to my knees, said my nightly prayers, and climbed into bed. Exhausted from the day of work and the mental energy I expended keeping up with the trial, I quickly drifted asleep. The places I went in my sleep haunted me. I'm standing on the gravel in the industrial park, headlights blinding my eyes. Cold and nervous, I don't know what to do, as a man points a gun directly at me. I sense death coming. Shots are fired at me, blasts that echo through the darkness as bullets rip through my skin. As I lie on the gravel, my neck grows weak, and then I'm paralyzed. Pain courses through me as I feel the heat radiating from each gunshot wound. I taste blood coating the back of my throat. Tears stream down my cheeks as the headlights of the car back away, driving off into the night. The smaller the taillights become, the more hopeless I am. Who will save me? How can I survive? My breathing becomes labored. As I lie here next to a white towel, my eyes grow heavy and close. Then I feel a warm and familiar hand grab my arm. My spirits are lifted. I am transported to Aaron's house. Suddenly, I am Aaron, and my fiancée, Cheyenne, is crying as she holds Aviel. Shai refuses to let go of my arm. A police officer places my hands together behind my back, snapping the handcuffs tight. I duck into the back seat of the cop car. I try to look out the window, but my knees are pressed against the driver's seat, making it nearly impossible to move. I squeeze my eyelids shut, hoping this nightmare will end, but noises distract me. Voices bark from the police radio. A siren sounds, and the car vibrates from the thrum of the helicopter hovering above. I become lightheaded. Now the doors open, and now I flash in and out of characters. I am Odin. I am Aaron. I am Bo. I am Carlos. I feel someone shaking me. It is my mother, snapping me out of this terrifying dream. When I actually woke up, I was alone in Iowa City, my body and my entire bed soaked with sweat. Different versions of this dream tormented me nightly. The explicit details and the clear cinematic quality of the visions made me afraid to fall asleep. I had become obsessed with the trial, thinking about it all day, and now I was living in it within my nightmares. During the trial, I asked a girl named Karen out on a date. I first saw her at a mall near campus where she worked in a retail store. Hesitant to approach while she was working, I contacted her over social media. I eventually asked her out to dinner and was delighted when she said yes. But on the designated night, as I was grabbing my coat from the closet to go meet her, she texted to cancel. 2 months later, as the trial was nearing its end, she texted and gave me a second chance, with one stipulation. She wanted to bring a coworker. At first I thought she was joking, but then I realized I was the only one laughing on the phone. After our call ended, I put myself in her shoes and thought, would I do the same thing? The three of us had a wonderful dinner. The conversation flowed naturally, and I thought there was a chance that this might lead to another date. Walking Karen to her car afterward, I asked why she had canceled our first date. I enjoyed our phone conversation and was really looking forward to dinner, but when I told my coworkers about a date with you, everyone started to panic, she said. I had no idea who you were related to, and initially I had no idea who Aaron was. Then my boss came to me and said, out of all of the guys in Iowa, you choose to go on a date with Aaron Hernandez's brother? I just needed more time to think. I understood and hugged her before she got into her car. Back home, I fiddled with my phone, not knowing if I should text her. I didn't want to appear clingy, but then I felt my phone vibrate. It was a text from Karen. I had a really good time, she wrote. Excited, I gave myself a little fist pump and said aloud, "Victory!" Chapter 32. April 15th, 2015. It began as a normal Wednesday morning at the University of Iowa. I attended an 8 a.m. staff meeting, but as I sat in a corner of the conference room, I kept glancing at my phone, hoping to receive a text that the jury had reached a verdict. During the trial, Aaron and I spoke at least once a week over the phone. We never discussed the details of the case because Aaron knew his calls were recorded and was afraid anything he said could be taken out of context. But in his letters, he expressed optimism about his innocence being proven. I knew it could go either way. It all depended on how the jury interpreted the evidence. Still, I had been confused from the opening statements. I didn't understand how four guys could go into an industrial park and how the three who left would have different charges brought against them. Aaron's charges were more severe than Bo's and Carlos's, in spite of no murder weapon being found or surveillance showing who actually pulled the trigger. The meeting at Iowa ended. I walked to my desk, which was in an open area clustered with eight other desks. As I approached my space, I looked at the television on my desk, tuned to a news channel. A scroll on the bottom read, "The jury in the Aaron Hernandez trial has reached a verdict." My heart jackhammered. The television switched to the courtroom, where I saw my brother standing with his lawyers by his side as he waited for the jury's decision. I couldn't take my eyes off him, praying the jury would announce a not guilty finding. Then the words were read by the jury foreperson. "Guilty of murder in the first degree." Everything fell silent. I was numb. I stared at Aaron on the screen. When he heard the words "guilty of murder in the first degree," I saw him deflate and thought he was going to fall. He was in shock. I felt it. He turned to my mother and Shy, who had their hands over their faces, sobbing, their bodies shaking. Aaron mouthed, "Be strong." It felt like my own life was over. I tried to hold myself together, but then I couldn't suppress the emotion. Tears rolled down my cheeks. I felt hands pat me on the back and heard someone asking me if I needed to take a walk. But I couldn't.
It would have felt like I was leaving my brother, so I continued to watch the television.
I continued to cry with my hands on the side of my head like a horse wearing blinders. I knew this meant that Aaron might never be free again. Coach Kirk Ferentz came to me and placed his hands around my shoulders and whispered into my ear, "If you need anything or need to take time off to be with your family, just let me know." I kept thinking of my mother, who had driven by herself to the courthouse for the first time that morning. The family members she usually went with couldn't attend. Now, I worried that she wouldn't have anyone to be with as she made her way home on the 2-hour drive. I called my mother as she was waiting for the elevator outside the courtroom, but she said she couldn't talk. I told her I loved her. After I hung up, I saw the TV cameras bombard her as she pushed through the heavy courthouse doors to leave. I gave her a few minutes to get to her car and called her again to ask if she was okay to drive home.
"I'm okay, Dee," she said. "How are you?"
I didn't have the strength to respond. For what seemed like 5 minutes, there was silence between us. Finally, she said,
"You are going to be okay."
I started crying again. I somehow attended an 11:15 a.m. coaches meeting. I don't remember one word that was said. And then I finally took a walk. I went downstairs to the coach's locker room to be alone, trying to clear my head and balance my emotions. I looked up at a television in the locker room, tuned to ESPN, and saw commentators talking about my brother and his case. They kept going on and on about the $40 million contract he had signed and how Aaron had everything but threw it all away. I heard the door to the locker room open. I tried to bury my head deeper into my locker, hoping to look preoccupied. Coach Ferentz approached me again.
"I've been trying to find you," he said.
I looked at him, but I couldn't find any words to say.
"DJ, I can't imagine the pain you and your mother are feeling right now. I'm so sorry, and I am here for you if you need anything. Hang in there."
Crying, I stammered, "Coach, would you mind if I go home for the day? I'm just so exhausted right now, and I need to be alone."
"Of course," he said with kindness in his voice. "Just don't do anything stupid, and make sure you touch base with me in the morning." As I drove to my apartment, I wondered what Aaron was thinking.
Chapter 33. Summer, 2015. This would be the first time I would be seeing Aaron since he was convicted and sent to Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center, located in Lancaster, Massachusetts. It was a rare contact visit, and I wondered if I would be able to hug my brother. After clearing the security checkpoint with other visitors, I walked through the green, bulletproof doors and then down a long, narrow hallway. Along the right side of the white walls, through the window, I could see the barbed wire fence and an outdoor picnic table that sat alone in the sunshine. The sky was blue on this August morning, and I wondered if I was going to meet Aaron out there at the picnic table. I had no idea. I was just following the few visitors walking in front of me, who seemed to have experience with the contact visit protocol. An officer opened another door and guided us into a large open room filled with chairs lined in long rows facing each other. Four officers roamed the area. I watched inmates enter and embrace their loved ones. Then Aaron entered the room, and our eyes met. We both lit up. As soon as Aaron was close to me, I looked at the officer who was escorting him to see if it was okay for me to hug him. He nodded. We embraced, and then sat down. We were directly across from each other, 4 feet apart, a blue line of tape on the floor between us. For the first few minutes, we didn't say much. It was like we were two shy people trying to make conversation. It took time for me to process the entire scene and comprehend that this was where Aaron would spend the rest of his life. Aaron asked me if I liked his outfit. He was wearing a gray prison uniform, and his watch, which he wore on his left wrist and featured a thin black silicone band with a small digital face. He showed me his all-white prison-issued shoes and told me he'd cleaned them to look fresh for my visit. His prison clothes looked ironed and pressed. His shirt and pants were wrinkle-free. He'd recently gotten a haircut.
"How are you doing, Aaron?"
"You know, every day is the same."
He was much calmer and less talkative than the last time I had seen him in prison, 8 months earlier. It was like his body was recovering from the shock of the verdict 4 months ago. He seemed heartbroken and internally wounded. I leaned into Aaron as close as I could without going over the blue line.
I had to ask my brother if he did it. We both knew his letters were monitored and his phone calls were reviewed, so I knew he couldn't fully open up about what transpired the night Odin was killed. But now it was just brother in front of brother. I needed to hear his answer in person, face to face, eyes to eyes, without glass separating us. I needed to know Aaron's truth. What the fuck happened that night? I quietly asked. Aaron shook his head slowly for several seconds, back and forth, until my head started moving along with his rhythm. Then he whispered, "It's crazy." He was getting more upset as we looked into each other's eyes. "Aaron, I'm your brother and I love you no matter what," I said. "I need to know. Did you kill Odin?" With tears welling in his eyes, in a voice no louder than a whisper, he said, "Drugs will fuck you up, but not fuck you up enough to kill someone. I didn't do it, Dee. I did not do it." Chapter 34. My time as a graduate assistant coach was expiring, and I was about to be out of a job. Unable to find another coaching opportunity, I packed my life into a U-Haul and left the beauty of Iowa City. For 15 hours, I drove south, across the plains, until I reached Dallas, Texas, where one of the Hawkeye coaches had a connection with a local roofing and remodeling company. They had a sales position available, and I accepted. Still in the beginning phases of our relationship, Karen stayed back in Iowa City, but we vowed to continue a long-distance relationship. It was time for a new beginning. I moved into an apartment. The challenge of starting over and leaving the true love of my life, football, was nerve-wracking. Besides lemonade sales as a kid with Aaron, I didn't have any sales experience. After a few months, I started a company called High Rise Roofing and Remodeling. Shortly after, a massive hailstorm pounded the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. I was about to perform a roof inspection when the storm hit. I quickly climbed down my ladder as hailstones the size of golf balls hammered the ground. Within hours, I had dozens of homeowners calling me, panicked by the hail that had blasted through their roofs, smashed through their windows, and ripped apart their siding. As I drove through the pitch-black neighborhood, the power was out in this section of the city, my headlights beamed onto cars that were flattened as if massive oaks had fallen on top of them. Shards of glass were everywhere, covering streets, sidewalks, and lawns. I parked my truck and worked with others to tarp roofs. Then the rain began to fall, and it became too slippery for us to maintain our traction. With a flashlight in hand, I inched down off the roof and down the ladder. We then boarded up windows and swept up glass. Helping others lifted me out of my funk. These new relationships gave me a sense of purpose again. I relished sitting in living rooms with families, drinking coffee and listening to them talk about their lives and the progress they were making in returning to normalcy after the storm. In January 2016, I flew with Karen back to Bristol to introduce her to my mother and Aaron for the first time. After arriving at the prison in Massachusetts, we stepped out of the car and proceeded toward the front entrance. Holding hands, our grip was firm as we walked alongside the barbed wire fence. "Are you sure you want to do this?" I asked. "I'm ready," she said.
An officer met us in the waiting area and directed us through a doorway and into the visiting room.
We sat down and I rubbed Karen's knee, trying to ease her discomfort. Sitting upright, she was as stiff as a board. Then a buzzer sounded, and Aaron walked in. Karen didn't know what to do or say, so she just looked at me, even as Aaron was looking at her with his big smile. Aaron asked Karen how she was doing. She turned her head toward him and said, "I'm fine." Then she smiled.
Aaron and I started talking as Karen watched. She didn't know what to say, but she later told me that she had no idea that Aaron and I had such a strong bond, that we could effortlessly pick up a conversation as if we'd never been apart. She noted that we had the same hand gestures, facial expressions, and the same crease in our small foreheads when we laughed. At one point, Aaron pulled out his fake front teeth and started smiling. We all laughed because he was so goofy. The visit lasted an hour. As Karen and I got in our car, I asked her what she thought. "The time went so fast," she said. "I wanted to bottle it up. I saw so much love and emotion. I'll never forget that."
Chapter 35. October, 2016. Tanya Singleton, our cousin who was the person that Aaron confided in the most, was incarcerated for refusing to testify before the grand jury investigating the death of Odin Lloyd. After spending a few months in jail, she pleaded guilty to criminal contempt and was placed on house arrest. She was suffering from stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. My mother and Jeff remained distant from Tanya, and my mother continued to seethe. "I thought Tanya was brainwashing Aaron to be against me all those years," my mom said. "She never said no to him, and she would allow Aaron to do anything he wanted. She didn't teach him anything or discipline him. Instead, she would accept anything he wanted to do." In October 2015, Tanya passed away in a bed that was set up in her living room. After she died, my mom spoke to Aaron and noted that karma is a bitch, that Tanya's death was payback for her past actions. Aaron was deeply hurt by the comment, and he wrote her several stinging letters, spelling out the pain it caused him. 1 year later, my mother felt uneasy during her 2-hour car drive to Lancaster, Massachusetts. "I really didn't want to go," she said. "I hated seeing Aaron in that prison environment. I thought about how strange our lives turned out. I would have never believed that one day I'd be visiting my son in jail for murder charges." Whenever my mother visited Aaron, she never knew what they would talk about, or whether Aaron would be angry, happy, sad, spiritual, or ambivalent. On some visits, she couldn't wait to leave. On other occasions, she never wanted her time with Aaron to end. It all depended on Aaron's mood, which was unpredictable. What hurt her the most was saying goodbye after a positive interaction with Aaron. This conversation began with a normal exchange of pleasantries. "How are you doing, Aaron?" my mom asked from her side of the scratched plexiglass. "I'm good." "You look good, Mom," Aaron said. At first, Aaron was aglow, a big smile stretching across his face. Aaron continued, his smile slowly disappearing even as he tried to hold it. "You don't know me, Mom." "How could I possibly know more than you show or tell me?" my mom said. "I'm not a mind reader." "Do you remember when we used to get dropped off at the babysitter's house near the cul-de-sac?" Aaron asked. "Yes," she said. Aaron finally told her about one of the demons that had been haunting him all these years. He told her how the older boy would force him to perform oral sex. Aaron said it started when he was 6 years old and continued for several years. "Why didn't you tell me, Aaron?" our mom said as she began to sob. "I could have protected you." "I was afraid," Aaron said as he put his head down and began to cry. "There's more." For the rest of their time together, Aaron spoke in a whisper, occasionally just mouthing the words to our mother so the officers and other visitors couldn't hear. "Mom, I'm gay," Aaron said. "Oh, Aaron," my mom said, still crying. "I can't even imagine having to hide this." "My biggest fear was the thought of someone finding out," Aaron said. "Growing up, Tanya was the only person who knew. She was the only one who knew for a long time."
Oh my gosh, Aaron.
I've been hiding my true love from everyone, Aaron said. Before I was even a teenager, we had sleepovers together, and sometimes we would just cuddle and sleep with each other. As we got older, I'd go over to his house, and we'd go into his bedroom and fool around. I saw him whenever I could. Once I was in the NFL, I'd call him every day after practice. If he was free, I'd go see him, and we'd just cuddle and talk for hours. I wanted to leave the league so we could start a life together.
Aaron said that in order to become intimate with a woman, he needed to be extremely drunk. He loved Cheyenne, but it had crushed him that he couldn't give her the intimacy that she deserved. Aaron said he would stay out late with his friends, hoping that she would be asleep when he returned.
I hated living a secret, and I hated all the lies, but I felt like I had to do all those things because people wouldn't accept me, Aaron said. There was no way I could come out as an NFL player. I know it's wrong and that men aren't supposed to be gay, Aaron whispered. You think I like being this way? I don't. If it got out in jail that I was gay, I'd be killed.
Aaron told our mother that he didn't want me to know either of his secrets.
I can't let DJ down, Aaron said.
Aaron, your brother loves you regardless of anything, my mother said. You should tell him.
I can't, Mom, he said. I don't want to let anyone in our family down. I don't want to let my friends down, and I don't want to let the fans I have left down. I just can't.
I love you more than ever, my mom said.
Tears in his eyes, Aaron said,
I love you too, Mom.
Then a prison guard said time was up. The visit was over. Aaron wiped his tears, stood up, and hardened his demeanor before walking back and joining the other inmates. Chapter 36. March 2017. 5 months had passed since Aaron had opened up to our mother, and now I was going to see him for the first time since he had let his walls down. I walked through the prison's thick green doors, down the narrow hallway, and sat on the stool. In the non-contact visitor's room, on the other side of the plexiglass divide, Aaron appeared. Before Aaron picked up his phone, I wanted to blurt out, I'm here for you. Your sexual preference does not matter to me. My love for you is unconditional. But I didn't. With the phone to his ear, Aaron sat down, subdued. I asked him how he was doing.
It's Groundhog Day, he said. Every single day is the same.
Aaron had to open up and give me the chance to listen. He had told our mom not to tell anyone, but it was too much for her to handle by herself, so she phoned me. Hearing the news had been horrifying. I was angry that I had been blind to the molestation, his hurt, and his inner conflict. I hadn't protected my brother. It devastated me to learn how much pain Aaron's secrets were causing him. In the visiting room, Aaron didn't have much to say, so I started telling stories from our childhood. He looked at me like someone who is hearing this information for the first time. He tilted his head to the left, but his eyes were focused on something past me, through me, mimicking that thousand-mile stare he had on the rooftop in Los Angeles. I could feel his pain on the other side of the glass. He looked lost. Aaron never opened up to me. Returning to my mom's condo, I felt like I needed to be closer to Aaron. There was a distance growing between us that made me uneasy. I started to think that I should move home. But back in Dallas, Karen was 3 months pregnant. I wasn't going to make any major decisions until our baby was born. Chapter 37. November 4th, 2016. 2 days before Aaron's 27th birthday, Karen and I checked into Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. We sat in the waiting room and spotted another family who had sleeping bags spread across the floor. It looked like they were tailgating or waiting in line for coveted concert tickets. I pictured what the scene would look like if my childhood family had been with us. My father would be crying, my mother would be next to him.
Aaron would be at my side, and my aunts and uncles would be pacing the halls, waiting for updates.
Karen was in a lot of pain.
Sitting next to her, I felt helpless because I was unable to ease her discomfort.
Doctors came in and out of the room, and at one point they asked me to step into the hallway so they could give Karen an epidural. I knew what an epidural was because of how often my brother was given one for his ongoing back pain in football. The birth was getting closer. We were guided to another room because it was almost time to start pushing. I was getting nervous. All I wanted was for Karen and the baby to be healthy. I could feel Karen's pain as she squeezed my hand during contractions. Suddenly, I felt like a cheerleader.
"Babe, I can see her head," I said.
"She is coming. Keep pushing, babe. Keep pushing." I was so excited I didn't know what to do. I looked back up at Karen and said, "Keep breathing, keep pushing. I can see her shoulders, babe." I couldn't take my eyes off Parker as the nurse raised her to Karen. I was in awe. Karen had a look on her face I had never before seen, one of accomplishment, exhaustion, and maternal love. Parker weighed 6 pounds, 3 ounces. She was so precious. A nurse put a diaper on her. Parker looked like a little peanut with a hat. A nurse took us to a private room on the maternity ward, and I held Parker for the first time. It was perfect. Like many new dads, I worried about dropping her, but I held on. For the first time, I knew what Aaron meant when he said that he didn't want anyone to drop his princess, because now, with Parker in my arms, I didn't want anything to happen to her. I never wanted to let go. 2 days later, we loaded Parker into her car seat, buckled her in, and then drove home. I was the slowest driver on the freeway, the cars racing past us as we turtled along in the slow lane. I constantly checked the rearview mirror. Karen's face hovered over the car seat with the biggest smile I had ever seen. Chapter 38.
March 2017. 4 months later, I was in my office at Ledyard High School in Ledyard, Connecticut, when my phone rang. I had only been on the job for 4 weeks. I was the head football coach and an academic and behavioral support supervisor, and during my interview I promised the superintendent that Aaron's situation wouldn't be a distraction or bring unwanted publicity to the school. I answered the phone. "Two officers are en route to the school to speak with you about your brother," the school principal said. Aaron's second trial began 1 month earlier, and I had no idea why police officers would want to visit me. I wondered if I had made the right decision to move my family back to Connecticut a month earlier to be closer to Aaron and my mother. The principal popped her head into my classroom. "The two officers are waiting for you in an office just a few doors down," she said. I entered the room, shut the door behind me, and shook the officers' hands. "How can I help?" I asked. The trial for Aaron's double murder had started on February 14th, 2017. I didn't know anything except what Aaron had told me. He couldn't believe he was even going to trial for this. The prosecution alleged that in July 2012, Aaron was at a Boston nightclub when Daniel De Abreu spilled a drink on Aaron. They claimed that 2 hours later, Aaron, enraged over the incident, opened fire from his silver Toyota 4Runner on De Abreu's silver BMW, killing De Abreu and Safiro Furtado. The officers who met me at Ledyard read a packet of information that stated the date and time they wanted me to appear at Suffolk County Courthouse, March 23rd, 2017, at 9:30 a.m.
prosecutors wanted to speak with me. A few days later, I went to the courthouse at 3 Pemberton Square in Boston to meet with prosecutors. I took a seat in a small room at a rectangular wooden table. Then, Assistant District Attorney Patrick Hagen entered.
"I just want to ask you a few questions about your brother. I'm not sure whether or not I'll call you to the stand. I understand how much your family has been through, and I know you just accepted the position at Ledyard High School."
On a TV monitor, he displayed images of Aaron's tattoos. He asked me if I knew the meaning of his various tattoos, which covered his body from neck to toe. "I have a lot going on in my life," I said, "and studying my brother's tattoos isn't one of them. He has too many for me to keep track of. I told the officer I only knew of a few."
"Do you know of any nicknames that your brother went by?" he asked.
"Yes," I said. "I call him Air at times, which is short for Aaron, and his teammates called him Chico. I have no idea why they called him that." He then read off a list of nicknames. I told him I didn't recognize any of them.
"Would you mind listening to a recorded phone conversation to see if you can identify the voices?"
"Sure," I said. He played the conversation on a computer. It was a conversation between my brother and mother, which was what I told him. He then asked how everything was going at the school.
"Good," I said.
He mentioned that he grew up close to Ledyard, and we talked about the area. He said that he would let me know if I'd be called to the stand. I had chosen not to be in the courtroom for the first few weeks of Aaron's second trial. It felt like I was being pulled in two directions. Half of me wanted to see Aaron's face, to make eye contact with him, to let him know through my presence that I loved him. But the other half of me couldn't do it. The thought of stepping in that courtroom made my body pulse harder and shake. Over the weekend, after being interviewed by the prosecution, one of Aaron's lawyers, Ronald Sullivan, called and told me that Aaron would really like to see me in court. I told him I was planning on attending and was going to see if any other family members would want to join me. He also asked me what I knew about his tattoos. I told him I knew the meaning of only a few. He told me that the prosecution was trying to link Aaron to the murders by his tattoos, specifically one of a gun chamber they believed Aaron had gotten that commemorated the crime. Aaron's defense team argued that the tattoo was just one of many he'd put on his body because he'd liked the look. "Aaron was addicted to tattoos," I told one of Aaron's lawyers. "There was a time I asked Aaron about a particular tattoo and what it meant. He said, 'I don't know, but it looks cool, and I got the same tattoo a few times.'" Dating back to when Aaron was a kid, he loved to cover his body with fake tattoos. His obsession never stopped. Aaron's lawyer thanked me and said the prosecutors wanted to call me to the stand to give the impression that I was testifying against Aaron. Then, a few days later, he sent me a text saying that I was not going to have to speak at the trial. I was beyond relieved.
Chapter 39. April, 2017. On April 1st, with the trial nearing its conclusion, I called my mother and asked if she would go to support Aaron with me. "I can't do it again," she said. "One murder trial was enough. I can't do two. I can't hurt like that anymore." I begged her, but she was adamant about not attending. On April 3rd, I began my morning leading the Ledyard football team in spring workouts. Then, after showering in the coach's locker room, I changed into my jacket and tie and met 3 family members in the school's parking lot, my uncles David and Vito and my aunt Lisa. Together, we drove to the courthouse in Boston. On the way, I thought about the magnitude of this case. If Aaron was found guilty again, he would never come home. If he was innocent, he then would have a chance to appeal the Odin Lloyd case and seek a new trial. We arrived at court and sat on Aaron's side. Once the testimony for the day ended, I waited in my seat, hoping Aaron would turn around. He remained facing forward until one of his lawyers whispered into his ear to tell him we were present. Aaron stood up from his chair, looked at us, and quietly mouthed, "Thank you," over and over, his eyes traveling to each of us. He then looked back at me and flashed a smile, one that brought me back to Greystone. "I love you," he mouthed. We stared at each other for several long seconds. "I love you, Air," I mouthed back. I watched him as he walked out of the courtroom. I wanted to soak this time up. I hadn't seen him in 10 months. But then, too fast, he was gone, the door closing behind him. After attending one day of trial, I was the only certified coach on staff, which meant the kids wouldn't be able to work out if I wasn't present. I received a text on April 5th stating that closing arguments would begin. The prosecution's main witness was Alexander Bradley, a.k.a. Sherrod. He testified that he pulled up to the side of a silver BMW, and from the passenger seat, Aaron leaned out of the driver's side window and began shooting into the car. Aaron's team of lawyers, led by Jose Baez, poked holes in Sherrod's testimony, questioning the authenticity of his statements and the quality of his character. Aaron and I didn't talk on the phone during the trial, at the request of his lawyers. But the one time I met with Aaron's lawyers, they told me that the prosecution was desperate and the case against Aaron was weak. I had no idea what the jury would decide, especially following the guilty verdict from Aaron's first trial. After work on April 14th, Karen was driving and I was in the passenger seat on our way to an appointment to look at an apartment. I received a text from my mother telling me that the verdict was in. I went to a link on Twitter and watched it live. Staring into my iPhone screen, I heard, "Not guilty. Not guilty." Aaron was nodding his head up and down as he began to cry. I was taken by my brother's emotion. I realized that we now had a slim chance to one day be reunited outside the prison walls. On Saturday, April 15th, only one day after the verdict, Karen, Parker, and I drove to my mother's condo for Easter weekend. That afternoon, we went to the West Farms Mall so we could take pictures of Parker with the Easter Bunny for the first time. Waiting in line, I couldn't believe it. A few feet away in front of us was Aviel, Shai's mother, and Shai's younger sister. We all hugged, and I just stared at Aviel. My mother smiled the entire time, saying over and over, "I know your daddy loves you. I know your daddy loves you." We took a picture, me holding Parker and Shai's younger sister holding Aviel. In that instant, I felt happiness, pain, and the distance that had grown between all of us. The next day, Easter Sunday, my mother came running into the condo from the garage. She had her phone on speaker. It was the voice of the automated recording from jail, preparing us to receive a call from Aaron. Then Aaron said, "Hello?" "You did it! You did it!" my mother shouted. "I'm so happy for you." She told Aaron about Parker and Aviel seeing each other at the mall for the first time and started talking about how excited she was for Aaron and his lawyers to start working on his appeal in the Odin Lloyd case. "Slow down, Mom," he said. "Let's just enjoy this outcome right now." My mom handed me the phone. "Congratulations," I said. "I love you more than anything in the world. I'm going to come visit you soon." "I love the both of you," Aaron said. "I don't have much time left, and I need to call Shai and Aviel." And the call ended. 3 days later, on April 19th, 2017, my brother died by suicide in his prison cell. Chapter 40. April 2017. On April 23rd, 2017, the funeral director at O'Brien Funeral Home in Bristol pointed down the long hallway, past the wooden chairs, and at the same white French doors that led to the room that had housed our father's casket nearly 11 years earlier. I pulled the door open and immediately shifted my eyes to the right, away from my brother's body. I couldn't look at Aaron. I wasn't ready. I moved to the back of the room, behind the 8 rows of chairs, where I paced and paced and paced, trying to build up the courage to kneel by his side. I slowly stepped closer. I reached the casket and looked at my brother for the first time. I saw his stiff hands interlocked on his chest, his sunken cheeks, and his scrunched little forehead. I lowered to my knees. For 30 minutes, I rested my head on his chest and closed my eyes. So many snapshots of Aaron flashed in my head. His smile, his laugh, his competitiveness, and his emotional response when he heard the verdict in his second trial. Holding him, tears rolled down my cheeks, dripping onto his chest. I whispered, "I love you, Aaron. I love you, Aaron. I love you, Aaron." Still kneeling, I raised my head and noticed a petite shadow appear through the long white curtains covering the window behind my brother. I'd asked my mother to give me an hour alone with Aaron, and it was now her time to join us. I gave Aaron a kiss on his cold forehead as I rubbed my right hand over his thin black hair. It was time to back away from the casket. Wearing dark cat-eye sunglasses, my mother entered the room. She turned her face to Aaron, paused, and then looked at me. My emotions erupted. I started bawling and wiping tears away with my hands. My mom removed her shades and took several hesitant steps closer to Aaron's body. She fell to the kneeler cushion in front of the casket, dropped her neck down, and began to rub Aaron's right hand. Sitting in a chair a few feet away, I buried my head in my hands and quietly said, "Why did you have to leave us, Aaron? Why?" Chapter 41. December 2017. On December 15th, I pulled out of my driveway in Pawcatuck, Connecticut, and steered through the snow in search of answers. The day my brother passed, my mother signed forms to release Aaron's brain to the Brain Bank, run by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Boston University, and the Concussion Legacy Foundation in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. I needed to connect the dots, to understand my brother's erratic behavior. I sought out Dr. Ann McKee, the director of the foundation and the nation's foremost expert on chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. I drove to the hospital in Jamaica Plain. Could detailed stories of my brother's life help Dr. McKee and other doctors better understand CTE? Would this information help other families whose loved ones were experiencing similar symptoms? I had read news reports detailing how Dr. McKee had found that Aaron suffered the most severe case of CTE ever discovered in a person his age. She had said that the brain damage was most severe in the frontal lobes of his brain, a brain area critical to decision-making, judgment, and cognition. CTE is a degenerative brain disease most commonly found in football players, soldiers, and other individuals who've experienced repeated blows to the head. Aaron had been diagnosed with severe CTE, stage 3 out of 4 possible stages. Stage 3 CTE is usually found in football players who pass away at the median age of 67 and played at least a decade in the NFL. Aaron wasn't a 10-year NFL veteran. He played in only 3 NFL seasons, 38 total games, and he was only 27 years old. Aaron is one of the hundreds of former athletes who are part of the VABU-CLF Brain Bank and have been diagnosed with CTE. Were Aaron's problems in life, depression, sudden aggression, impulsivity, impaired moral judgment, memory loss, difficulty planning and carrying out tasks, substance abuse, suicidal thoughts or behavior, clinical features of CTE? Were these difficulties found in other football players diagnosed with CTE? Aaron began playing tackle football at age 7, and he missed only one season, 8th grade, because he weighed too much to participate in the league. His NFL career was short, but in total, he played tackle football for more than 15 years. He played in more than 130 youth, high school, collegiate, and NFL games combined. His long playing career put him at a high risk for CTE. How many blows to the head did he take in his career? What is CTE's magic number? How many hits does it take until a brain is damaged? Does it matter that he started to play football at such a young age? I took a seat in Dr. McKee's office at Boston Medical Center. She showed me images and slides of Aaron's brain, explaining that if Aaron had lived, he was most likely 10 years away from being totally impaired. 30 minutes into our conversation, I started to tell Dr. McKee some of Aaron's personal history. There were times as early as second and third grade when we would be playing video games and Aaron would just snap, I said. He would take his Sega Genesis controller and beat me with it. Anything before that? She asked. The top of a hammer hit him in the head when he was about 8, I said. He dropped to the ground. Blood came out of his ears and nose. Did he go to the hospital? No. We were both very young, I said. I brought him inside and did my best to help clean him up. Was he normal at birth? She asked. Did he hit his milestones for crawling and walking and talking? Everything was normal, according to my mother, I said. You noticed these episodes when he would snap? He'd have episodes where he'd say, D, it's like I black out, I said. He'd cry afterward. This happened frequently? About 4 or 5 times. You didn't think this was him having a short temper? She asked. It usually built up, and then it was like a light switch went off inside of him. Was he good in school? He was lazy at times, but was very smart and an honor roll student. Do you remember any time when Aaron saw stars after he was hit? No, but he was diagnosed with one concussion in high school. I remember him becoming frustrated because he couldn't return to the game. What else can you tell me about Aaron's childhood? I detailed the night terrors when Aaron woke up yelling, "They're going to get me, they're going to get me." Did he walk around in his sleep? She asked. Yes. He was in his own little world when he'd have these episodes. This was in second and third grade. So he was having nightmares, and he didn't remember those night terrors. He didn't remember, I said. Did you ever notice a big change in Aaron? The first time I noticed a big change in him was when I went to his house and saw that he was sleeping next to a knife. This was in March 2012. I described seeing the bags filled with marijuana at his condo and how he was convinced that people were after him. This is way beyond normal paranoia, she said. According to research, he sounds affected by CTE at that point. I told Dr. McKee that Aaron once asked me at a bar in Boston why I was talking to a college friend. I told him we were buddies, but for the rest of the night, Aaron looked at him suspiciously, keeping his eyes on him for an extended period of time. That's really important, she said. According to our experience with CTE, in over 350 brains, I would say that it is very likely that he's impaired at this point. Listening to you, the symptoms of CTE probably started in high school. We found CTE in some high school football players. According to what you are telling me, it may have started earlier than high school, with the early exposure to tackle football. CTE may have been developing in his brain and affecting his thought process by age 22. Although we know that CTE is related to repeated blows to the head, there may be other factors that put Aaron at a higher risk for CTE, such as specific susceptibility genes, but at this point we don't know. I became paranoid from his paranoia, I said. Something seemed wrong with him, and I didn't want to be around him. I assumed his paranoia was a result of the weed he had on him. I told her about the night Aaron threw his mattress out of his bedroom because he couldn't find his cell phone, and how he apologized the next morning. So, a trivial thing, and he has this very exaggerated reaction, she said. He seems really out of control. He sounds really frightening. Aaron said he was actually happy in jail for a period of time, I said. He thought being in prison brought the family back together, but he also said he would have ended it a long time ago if it wasn't for his family. He clearly sounds affected by CTE, she said. People with this condition can be very obsessive and paranoid.
He sounds self-aware that something is wrong, but that he can't control it. I then explained that Aaron was repeatedly molested